The teachings you are about to receive were freely offered. If you would like to make a donation to support their continuation, please visit us at awakenedheartproject.org.
This fall, I had somewhat of a transformative experience around patience and self-acceptance. So, two months ago, Jeff and I were teaching a weekend retreat, and I decided, we taught a retreat, and I wanted to talk about patience and self-acceptance. Something not working? Is the sound okay? Okay. So 2 weeks ago, Jeff and I were teaching a retreat, and I decided to talk about patience. Well, I decided that I was going to talk about patience, but we had a snowstorm, and so we had to send people home early, so I didn't get to talk about patience. So I've been thinking about it for a while and decided to talk about that this evening. And the title of this talk until just a few hours ago was patience. And the truth is that I think it's really about self-acceptance. But I spend more time talking about patience, but I think it's really about self-acceptance. So I need to be reminded to keep putting that in, because I think they're very, very, very connected. So you'll see how that unfolds. But anyway, since this week is a week where we're doing studying of Torah, I thought, well, I want to talk about patience and self-acceptance, but I should read the Parsha and see like what's going on. So and I was actually quite lucky. So God was definitely on my side. So the Parsha, Va'era, comes right after Moses has been commanded by God to travel down from Midian back to Mitzrayim, to Egypt, and his brother Aaron joins him, and he's supposed to give the children of Israel God's message that with a mighty and outstretched arm, God will liberate them. And the last couple of verses before Va'era, before this Parsha, Moses tries to do that, and in fact their lives get more difficult. And so he brings more misery, quote-unquote, from their perspective. And so then in this Parsha, God says to him, no, you need to go back and you need to tell them that I have remembered my covenant with your foreparents, and I've promised you a land and freedom. And so Moses, as we know, does that. And this is what happens. Vayedaber Moshe Kain el bnei Yisrael v'lo shamu el Moshe mikotzer ruach u'me'avodah kasha. So this translation is, and Moses spoke so. He relayed this promise unto the children of Israel. But they hearkened not unto Moses for impatience of spirit, kotzer ruach, and for cruel bondage, avodah kasha. So I think that statement, kotzer ruach, shortness of spirit. Well, we're going to get to that, actually. I'm going to do avodah kasha first, a cruel labor. I think that it's very, very important in our practice to notice what's going on in our lives. I mean, this is essentially the awareness practice. When we get balanced enough and centered enough, we have the ability to really see what's going on in the larger picture of our lives. And we can then also reflect on how that larger picture impacts what's going on inside of us. So for the children of Israel to be able to practice, to hear Moshe when they're in such dire circumstances, you know, to hear this guy come and say, I've been sent by this God who has promised you all these things. I mean, they've been in bondage for 400 years, 400 years, yeah? I think it's 400 years. You know, they're habituated, they're in bondage, they're in pain, they're suffering. So they couldn't hear Moses because of the external circumstances. And what the impact of those external circumstances are on their minds and on our minds is quite significant. It's something that we have to pay close attention to. And kotzer ruach, which got translated here as impatience. And I checked a bunch of different translations, and it literally in the Hebrew it is shortness of spirit, or as Rashi translates it, shortness of breath, which I thought was pretty amazing, right? That you can't be patient if you have a shortness of breath. So imagine what happens to us as we meditate on the breath. You know, I don't think the breath needs to get long, but as we're patient with our breath, you know, perhaps we then get to have the opposite of impatience of spirit, which might be patience of spirit. I like patience of spirit. I think that's what I like. But I'm not sure, because there's also longness of spirit, like shortness of spirit, longness of spirit. Or I wrote down also long-spirited. I don't know how that, I'm not so sure about that. It might be, so I'm looking for the counterpoint to shortness of spirit, which is what the Israelites had. And it might be that from a Jewish perspective, which is both biblical, rabbinic, and so on up, the concept of Erech Apayim, which is translated as long-suffering, is the counterpoint to shortness of spirit. That would be a traditional understanding. Erech Apayim is one of the 13 divine attributes that Moses gets to witness through God's eyes in Exodus. And it's a funny and interesting phrase. It's long suffering, right? We'll get to suffering and patience. They also go together. But I actually, I don't really like Erech Apayim in this instance. And I think it's important for me to explain why. I grew up reading the Torah in day school. And while I have a very deep love relationship with the God of the five books, my experience of that God is not really as a long-suffering. I mean, I don't know, long. It's not as Erech Apayim. Long-suffering is a very complicated word for me. But as a God that has this kind of infinite patience of spirit, that's not my experience of this God. And it's important for me to say that. I probably imagine that amongst you are people who can point out to me places in the biblical text where, in fact, God does exemplify Erech Apayim, and perhaps after the retreat you might do that. But as we work to read the text from our own experience, it's important to honor our experience and to say, oh, this is my experience and this is not my experience. So for longness or patience of spirit, the God of the Bible doesn't really do it for me. And it's partly because there is such an anthropomorphic human quality to the God of the Bible for me. And we see that really clearly. We see it in God's relationship with Abraham. You know, God says, I'm going to destroy the children of Sodom, and Abraham says, oh, no, 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 please be patient, be patient. And, you know, there's this relationship of one making the other patient, and there's a lot of confusion about, like, you know, who's the God here and who's not, I find anyway, in my experience of reading it. And, you know, it's incredibly clear in Exodus, where Moses is coming down with the tablets, where he's about to, and God says, he uses the word, the Erech HaPayim word, he uses, he says to Moses, I'm going to go down and I'm going to destroy the children of Israel. I'm going to let my anger burn against them. Yicha'af. It's let this anger happen. And Moses says, no, 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 no. You know, let me go down, it will be okay. And then Moses goes down, and his anger flares up at the children of Israel, the same word, you know, and he throws down the tablets. So while in some ways the patience, that's longness of spirit, or patience of spirit, in the traditional world, we might say, well, God exemplifies that. When I simply go to the God of the Bible, that's not what I get. I do actually find it somewhere else in the Bible, which I'll get to. But I don't find it with this God here. And in a text that we'll look at a little bit, the God of the rabbinic period is really who's pointed to as the one who shows this kind of patience of spirit. So that's interesting. So that was a little bit by way of introduction, going to my text and showing you how this is a sacred text, because, you know, I wanted to talk about patience, and there I go to the Parsha, and there it is. It's right there. And I think actually quite apropos example. So those of you who've been sitting with me know that I have three children, and one of my children is a almost 18-year-old son, and that experience in the past year or two has been quite a tumultuous experience and has taken me on a great ride of suffering and self-discovery. And actually, when we met last in June or July or whatever it was really sort of the most difficult time for me. And I got very, very sad and very low in my life. In some ways, it was my period of walking through a very, very dark valley. And because I had and still have such a commitment to my practice, I really paid attention to this question of what is going on, both in the, you know, what is the truth of what's unfolding outside, and what is the truth of what's unfolding inside, and how does my mind take what's happening outside and make it worse, or cut off from it, or whatever it is. As a practice instruction, that's very, very, very important to do. So when we are dealing with difficult situations, or when things that are very difficult arise, and what obstructed the children of Israel from hearing this covenantal promise from God was the difficulty of their lives and their shortness of breath. Right? So we have to pay attention to what's going on in the framework of our lives, to ask the question, you know, what is going on in your life? And how does that affect the state of your attention? You know, so for me, it's clear that if my children are in a situation that I am concerned about, that's unsafe, that may be true or not true. Right? My mind may say it's unsafe. It may not, in fact, be true at all. That my capacity to be, my capacity to be present might be fine, but the amount of distraction will certainly increase. You know, I can really see that as if my anxiety goes up, then I have much more distraction going on. If my heart is settled, if I feel like everybody is safe and, you know, all the ducks are where they're supposed to be, then my capacity to be present and clear is greater. And really the amount of disturbance is less. That's just true for me. That may not be true for you. You know, it varies. I would venture to say that there's somewhat of a gender thing here, you know, perhaps. Perhaps not. I don't think gender is necessarily related to sex. I mean, that's another talk, but anyway. So to really looking at your patterns and see what on the outside affects the inside and how that then affects your ability to hear God's word, to hear the promise, you know, is very, very important. So, let's see. Let me just say that I'm going to work on patience for a little while. Where's my clock? There are two aspects to patience. There is, Sylvia says that we can only practice patience in the face of a visiting stress. That's when we practice patience, in the face of a visiting stress. So, you know, we're sitting on our cushion, something happens to disturb us, a visiting stress, and we practice being patient. We practice staying present, being in the moment, or we're in our life. And there is a very real stress, you know. Somebody in your family gets ill, you know, or anything, whatever it is, we practice patience. And then there's this question of patience of spirit. And I think they're related. I think that as we practice patience in our life and we cultivate an awareness of how that works, then we can develop a patience of spirit, which is perhaps what can deeply root us, can really ground our practice. So, you know, one of the great things in my life is that I get to live with Jeff. It's a great blessing. And one of the great things is that he's a great support to my practice. And he's really a great support in me having to do these talks, which I would blame on him. I'm sort of like Norman. I'm not going to blame it on Alan, but I'll blame it on him. And so I say to Jeff, oh, you know, I need something Jewish on this, and I can't really find it in any of my books. And, you know, it's not where it's supposed to be. What I do is that he goes to the computer and he Googles and finds me all these great things. It's so great because I don't do that. That's what I rely on him for. So I said, patience. I need something on patience. So he gave me this thing. And it's so funny because you can get all these different things, right? You don't know where they come from. This is an article by Rabbi Wine. I don't know who Rabbi Wine is. And it was in the Jerusalem Post. And it's actually a very interesting article. And you can't really tell what denomination he's from or anything. I mean, it's a political article, so you get a little bit of a sense of his critique of the Israeli government and their ability to practice Erech HaPaim, or patience of spirit. But more than that, you don't know. So anyway, he says, patience is not really a Jewish virtue. And his proof text for that is a rabbinic debate in which a non-Jew is debating with a rabbi and says that we are an am keziza, we are a rash and impetuous people. Because when God came to us, we said, we will do and we will listen. And that is a rash and impetuous act. Which is like, you know, this is the thing about doing hermeneutics, doing interpretation. Some people could say that shows tremendous patience. You know, I think like there's a level of great patience of spirits to be able to do that. But anyway, that's not how he understood it. But so And also that it's an accusation by a non-Jew to a Jew. And it's, I looked it up in the rabbinic stuff, and it's a big thing. It's interesting. Anyway, I can't really read this, but he says, but as a general comment on broader Jewish behavior, one must admit that patience is not our strong suit. There is always great pressure in the Jewish world for things and goals, the Messiah, peace, prosperity, to happen now. And in our haste to accomplish these things, we often inadvertently, but almost always surely, postpone the achievement of that goal that we so fervently and impatiently desire. That's really an interesting practice instruction, or practice thing. In short, in spite of our long history and astute wisdom, we as a people have still failed to learn practice, and appreciate the virtue of patience in molding our national and personal character. So, I mean, I read that. I thought that was pretty interesting, and I thought, well, I mean, what people is a patient people? You know, I don't know. Is there such a thing as a patient people? I don't know. But it is interesting, and it is interesting, I think, this thing about how you interpret stuff, because one could say, I mean, I think we are impatient for the Messiah to come, and we are impatient to the return to the land, but there is also an aspect of great patience to have that be your eschatology, to have that be really what it is you're, you know, you're moving towards, you know, and you're cultivating towards. So that's an interesting thing. I liked that I learned about kizizah, which is impetuous or rash in Aramaic. In Hebrew, it's quite interesting, because the word for suffering, sevel, is the same root as patient, savlanut, savlan. So it's quite interesting, right? I mean, there is this deep connection here somehow between suffering and patience. And I think that this relates a lot to what happened to me this fall, which I guess I really haven't told you that much about. So when I was here in June or July, I was in a very difficult state because of behavior on our son's part that brought up all sorts of issues for me that were difficult for me to deal with. And I suffered a lot. I suffered a really, 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 really lot. And I was worried and I was anxious, and that increased my suffering. And, you know, I was trying to practice with it and trying to really, you know, figure it out. And I was very committed to looking at the ways in which I increased my suffering by, you know, my son actually did pass all of his classes for 11th grade, but, you know, in my mind, he had flunked everything. You know, that was pretty clear. I don't want to get into the story of Jesse, but, you know, it's unclear whether he should have been in school. He's not in school now, actually. And so this fall, he ended up going into the mountains with a program called Knowles, National Outdoor Leadership School, for 3 months. And so I knew where he was. It was sort of after a difficult summer where I never knew where he was and what was going on with him and what he was going to do in the fall, and, you know, having my anxiety about that. And then in the fall, he was in the Rocky Mountains. And I knew he was there, and I knew he was safe. Some people might not think that was safe, but I knew it was completely safe. So my ability to begin to reflect in a clearer way was greater. And it's not about reflecting, it's not about the clarity, it's about the anxiety level, which leads to a lot of discursive stuff. Because even with the discursive stuff, there are ways to be clear. There are lots of ways to be clear and using lots of different things. But what happened was I was practicing, I only had one child at home, and that's a pretty wild thing after many years. And I was practicing, my formal meditation practice was not so different, you know, regular sitting, but I was doing a lot of continuity of practice, and I was doing a lot of walking practice in the woods. And I was practicing tremendous, tremendous patience with myself, because, you know, I was so whacked out some of the time that there was pretty much little I could do. I mean, I have my obligations for where I teach, and you know, I had to walk my dogs, and I had to be in relationship, but my life was pretty bone bare because I was only doing what I had to do, and I didn't have the creativity to want to do anything else. And what happened was I had this profound shift of self-acceptance. There was like this way in which I was present and I was dealing with what was going on, and I could really look at it and know that it couldn't be any other way. And there was a way in which, in that process, I deeply, deeply accepted myself and my own limitations. And there was something very profound about that for me. I'm not somebody who is very patient with myself. And I have not been somebody who has been very self-accepting in a lot of ways. So as I move through this discussion of patience, you know, the question, Sylvia says, as I said, that we practice patience in the face of a visiting stress. So one of the questions as we work with patients is, what is our relationship to that stress? Are we trying to just wait until the stress goes away, like to get through it? Or is there something about being in the midst of the stress that we have to open up to? So as I was thinking about this and writing, this was a couple of weeks ago, it was actually the week that there was that ice storm out west, and Oklahoma was like decimated, remember, a couple of weeks ago? And I remember hearing on the radio the mayor or the governor saying he was asking for patience on the part of all the people who had no electricity. And I thought that was interesting. And then this week when I was writing it, Benazir Bhutto was assassinated. And I imagined, I didn't hear it on the radio, I imagined people asking for patience, you know, in dealing with these very troubling, very, very difficult situations. Or, you know, in my situation, and Rabbi Wine, actually, he must be of an educator because he really raises the question of children. You know, our ability to cultivate patience with our children who are reckless or provocative or inattentive. You know, how do we cultivate patience? How do we be patient in the face of those things? You know, natural disasters, assassinations, and our children. You see, I liken my children to these things. Well, we've got to bring it home, right? But it is a real question on our cushions, because on our cushions, you know, we sit there and these things come to us. They may be difficult or they may be very simple. And the question is, what is our attitude towards them? You know, how do we understand them? You know, if we're wise, we remember on our cushion that everything that happens is impermanent, you know, that it comes and it goes. And if we're lucky in our life, we remember that as well. And on our cushion, we open fully to the experience. We open, we feel, we let go, and we let the experience, we let the stress take its natural course. And the other thing we do is we don't over-identify with it. We try hard not to make it about us. You know, we let that visiting stress be a visitor then go. So when we're practicing patience, are we saying, be patient, be patient, be patient, it will end soon? Or are we engaged in the process enough that we're cultivating a capacity to simply abide, to simply be with the stress as it's unfolding? I think this abiding is what allows us to cultivate a patience of spirit. In truth, this is where practicing with patience with stress translates into practicing the ability to abide and cultivating a patience of spirit. So this might be also the Erech Apayim, long suffering. The Erech Apayim, the divine quality of patience. And Sylvia says about it is patience is more, as you know, I love Sylvia, so I love to quote her. She's been an incredible teacher for me about most everything, including patience. Patience is more the quiet moment-to-moment adjustment to unpleasant circumstances, done in the knowledge that they cannot be other. Right? The adjustment to the circumstances, the letting go piece, the piece of acceptance is knowing that the situation can't be any other way. You know, really letting that in. And that letting it in is really an expression of wisdom. It's an expression of understanding that we don't really have ultimate control. We can't control all the things that are unfolding around us. In fact, we're just a part of that unfolding. And we can be a part of that unfolding with a patience of spirit if we let go. So, you know, the question becomes like those people in Oklahoma, were they simply being patient until their electricity went back on? Or were they opening up to the fact that we live in a world where Katrina's happen, tsunamis happen, all sorts of things happen that we can't control. And that's sort of the truth about life. You know, that's the larger opportunity in that practice. And I don't know, with assassinations, with Bhutto's assassination, opening up to the fact that we live in a world where some people are so demoralized and so lost that hate is their only response. And that those things are not personal to us. You know, that hurricane didn't happen to hurt that person who lives in Oklahoma, or the ice storm, you know, or Katrina didn't happen to us personally, or that the hate isn't even really so personal. I mean, it gets directed personally, but it's hate. And with children, you know, for me, the journey is about, can I really open to the fact that my son has a different journey than I might have imagined, and that that's his path, and can I abide in that truth? I have enough time that I have to put on my sweater. I'm cold. Actually, just this is good. So, Rabbi Wein, I think this is part of the self-acceptance. He says, oh, no, that's not what I wanted to read. You know, Rabbi Wein goes on to say that Erech Apayim is the patience that we have to learn. And he says that it's a divine attribute, and that we should be inspired to emulate it. And the place that he chooses is the Yom Kippur liturgy, where God says that God will wait for us till the end of our days for our improvements and repentance. So I think that's nice, but it's still, there's still a change being asked of there. There's still repentance. They're still looking for, I mean, maybe that's the paradox of this practice. You know, we sit and we abide, you know, and when it's painful, we'd like it to change, perhaps. I don't know if, I mean, I think you can notice that desire for change and not get hooked by it and still be able to be present. So, as you can tell, I'm still tripped up on Erech HaPaim and God. But I'm not tripped up on the model who I did find biblically, who I think embodies patience. And it was an interesting thing how I came up with that, because I was conscious of the fact that we were doing Torah study, and as a feminist theologian and somebody who has a feminist perspective, who's been asked at different occasions to bring that to this venue, particularly by one retreat, the last retreat, I sort of felt like, oh, okay, what am I going to do? So, and it was interesting, right? Actually, somebody else is here. The last time we studied this, I brought some feminist texts to the table, and it was, you know, it was interesting what kind of responses people had. But I was thinking about what, so Jeff, as you know, I told you, he's my buddy, he helps me do this. So I was telling him what I was doing. He's going to say, well, but tell them how you get to be patient. I mean, you got to give them like real examples. So I thought, okay, so how do you do it? Right? I mean, I had this experience and I practice a lot. So I was thinking that there are three things that really build this patience of spirit. And those three things are, well, one of those three things is strength, gevura. And another word for that, which I learned from Norman, who's also an incredible inspiration for me, is persistence, the ability to return over and over again, which takes a lot of strength. And as we do it more, we develop the capacity more. And so I said to Jeff, I was telling him these three things, I've only told you one, and he said, well, you know, the archetype for Ushpizen, right? It's Ushpizen. Is it more than Ushpizen? Who stands for, it must be, Chana, the model of Chana. Chana stands for Gevura, right? That's true, Chana and Yitzchak, right? And does that only, is that used more than Sukkot for something, or is that just for Sukkot?
The seven shepherds.
But not the women. So here you have it. So I'm Chana and he's Yitzchak, right? So we have a relationship to these two. And
two will types.
well, I'm also Chana and Leah, so I have something else in there. And you do too. Anyway. So I love Chana. I've always loved Chana. She's been a very important figure in my growing up. I named for both my paternal great-grandmothers, Chana and Leah, and I grew up very, very identified with that. And I lived in Israel, so I was called Chana for a long time, and I loved her as a biblical model. And she really embodies these three qualities. Now, again, you have to remember this is Torah study. So when we study sacred texts, the text jumps out at you. It's not, there are many other things about Chana as well, right? So, but I do think for my purposes here, and that I think I'm saying that because it's important to really understand that studying Torah is a subjective endeavor. You know, we should appreciate that, that's how this practice of interpretation works. So, the three qualities are right concentration. My concentration over these months in the fall was quite strong. And that, again, comes, my concentration Different people understand concentration differently, but I do believe that bringing back the attention over and over again to the present moment builds concentration. And the value of that is that when we're in the present moment, we have a unified experience. We have the potential for a unified experience. The body and the mind can come together in the present moment. And it allows for balance, real balance, but it also allows for, it engenders buoyancy and bliss, because everything is together. You know, there's not this disparate pull. It just comes with concentration. So, you know, as we practice, you know, am I getting more concentrated? You know, leave the questions aside. It happens. It just happens. It happens on the cushion. It happens off the cushion. And it is aided by strength, like the commitment to do it over and over again. But I'm not going to talk about that yet. The other thing that I had really thought of, and so Hannah, you know, she's the mother of concentration, because in our understanding, avoda, our prayer practice, is our concentration practice. And she is the mother of prayer. I mean, for those of you who don't know her story, and I guess probably a lot of you don't know her story, so it doesn't mean anything when I tell you that, but I'll tell you. So Hannah was a woman, like most of the matriarchs, who was aruma. That's the wrong word. Sorry. Her womb was empty. She was called barren. Okay. She wanted to get pregnant, and she had a lot of dignity. That's how she's portrayed. And so she goes to the temple and she prays. And she's a figure of prayer. She prays such that Eli the high priest thinks she's drunk and says, you know, will you ever stop being drunk? And she says, you know, with a great amount of dignity, I'm not drunk, I'm praying. And God hears her prayer. She gets pregnant. And the other quality that I bring into this that's important for developing patience of spirit besides concentration is knowing towards what end we practice, having aspirations. Having little aspirations, medium-sized aspirations, and big-sized aspirations. Hannah knew what her aspiration was. She wanted a child who she could devote to God. Her commitment, her bargain with God was, as soon as he's old enough to be weaned, I will offer him to you. So she brings her son Shmuel, as soon as he's weaned, back to the temple. And he becomes one of the great figures for us. Great figure. And in my practice, in my life, and certainly this fall when I was really dealing with, when I was having this moment, and in my life all the time, I have little and big and medium-sized aspirations. You know, it may be that you sit at your cushion and you aspire to use as much effort in that sit as you can. Or it may be that you aspire to be free. Or it may be that you aspire to love your loved one just as they are. Or it may be that you aspire to practice restraint. Whatever it is, I find it enormously helpful to really put out for myself aspirations that change over time. I mean, those of you who've sat with me for years know that I play with this. So, like, I have aspired in my life to always give when asked, in ways that are appropriate, you know? I've taken that on as a practice, or I've aspired always to tell the truth at certain times in my life, which has really changed my practice, you know? And right now, One of my large aspirations is to practice such to be able to come to a place of balance such that regardless of the visiting stress, I can respond with ease and generosity. And that's like a very big aspiration, like for whatever is happening, that I should be able to respond with ease and generosity, peace and generosity. So I understand that's like a very large order, right? So then there are other little ones that take me there. So as I said this morning in response to Yocheved's question, one of my aspirations is when my loved ones present me with something, to really notice whether I can just simply accept it, you know, as it is, and accept them for who they are, you know. So, you know, right now I have something that I have to, actually I'll tell you now, someone in my family also died this week, my sister-in-law's father. And my sister-in-law is very dear to me, so I'm going to leave on Thursday to go to his funeral. I'll leave tomorrow night, so you all know I'll leave tomorrow night after the talk, and I'll be back hopefully early Friday. But I would like my son to join me. And my son may or may not join me. I don't know. So I have a real aspiration that I'm working with right now, to be able to meet whatever comes with a peaceful and benevolent heart. Right? So that's like a very, that's a tall order too, right? But, you know, you break it down. So aspirations, I think, are very, very important, can be, for trying to learn how to have this patience of spirit. So right concentration, like, developing a certain level of settledness in the mind, which allows for rapture and balance and buoyancy. Keeping our aspiration in mind, which dispels doubt. Remembering why we're doing this and fuels our wholesome desires. And the third one is strength, or persistence, as Norman says. And that's really the ability to return over and over and over and over again. And for those of you who are interested in this aspect, Norman has a chapter in his book, Taking Our Places. I don't know if it's a chapter or something. It's on persistence. It's great. It's great aid to, I mean, this is also an aspiration of mine. So I actually wrote it down and I carried it with me all fall. And one of the reasons I think that I was able to practice patience, which led to self-acceptance, was because I had this little aspiration in my car. And every time I was bored or needed something to do, I read it to remind myself what I was doing, right? What my aspiration was. I think that's how this works for some people. I don't know, but this is how it works for me. I'm not going to quote Norman, because last time I quoted Norman in E-Camp, I quoted him long. So I'm going to paraphrase it. The practice of persistence, the practice of coming back over and over and over again, allows us to deal with our, it exercises the muscle of strength and the ability to return. And in that, when we are confronted with frustration, as we learn to come back over and over again, rather than being frightened by our frustration, we're strengthened by our frustration. You know, we get stronger in knowing that we can deal with things. And in that process, you know, hope or acceptance or a certain kind of knowledge is born that things won't necessarily be how we like them to be, but whatever comes our way, we'll be able to deal with it. We'll be able to open to it, and it'll be okay. There's sort of a trust. There's a trust. And I think in order to get to that place, there has to be a level of self-acceptance. There has to be a level of knowing that I can't be any different than I am. This is who I am. And I don't have to over-identify with it. You know, that self-acceptance comes with letting go a little bit. Like, you know, this is just what this heart mind does. And I think Chana is a figure of great strength. So I think those three things really help to build patience of spirit. So there were two other things I wanted to say. I'm right on time, so that's good. One is, I started this fall taking an art class, a printmaking class. And my mother is an artist, and many of my closest friends are artists. So I had every art class in the world as a kid, and I think I always thought I was supposed to be an artist and rebelled quite early against that. And have been very phobic of doing any kind of art. I mean, I do, I knit some, I crochet some, I put together photo albums, things like that. But I decided that part of my practice needed to be doing some kind of creative work, that was really important. So I decided to take a printmaking class at the Woodstock School of Art. And it's a great place. It's a great place. And just because people always ask, I'm doing linoleum cuts. That's work I'm doing. But in the class, woodcuts happen, and etchings happen, and monotypes happen, for those of you who are interested. And the class is a class that's completely set. Like, those people have been doing it for years, and I just joined it. It happens every Friday. And it's incredible. It's an incredible experience of patience of spirit. There may be like 12 people in the class who come regularly. I mean, only 8 come regularly. And I'm the youngest. And the guy who founded, the vast majority of people are, you know, 60s, 70s, and 80s. And the man who founded the school, Bob Angelak, who is a fine, fine printmaker, is in the class. He was the teacher of the class for many years. He's got one wife and an ex-wife who are in the class. And the woman who teaches the class is a woman named Kate McLaughlin, who is a fine printmaker. She's younger than me. She's the youngest person in the class. She's 2 years younger than me. She came to the Woodstock School of Art as a painter and started studying printmaking with Bob Angelak, this guy. And he sits in his desk that he always sat in as the teacher, and she sits in her desk that she always sat in as the student, and she's the teacher now. He is fairly not there, you know, in terms of his brain, or I don't know what the politically correct thing to say is, but he completely can do his art. And if you talk to him about his art or your art, he's totally on target. If you try to talk to him about anything else, you can't have a conversation. So he has an ex-wife in the class who also has been doing printmaking for years. And she has a real memory loss. So Kate, who is devoted, is a devoted teacher, and one of, you know, like one of the Lama Dvaviniks, one of the 36 righteous people in the world. She teaches the class. And when it's quite amazing. I'll just talk about these two people. There are other people in the class also like them. The ex-wife doesn't remember how to do her craft. She knows how to do it, but she doesn't remember what she's supposed to do next. So Kate reminds her how she would have done it. She comes to Kate with her work and she says, I don't know what to do next. And Kate says, well, you would have done it like this. And then she reminds her enough, so she sits down and she does it. And Bob, I've been in the class for a couple of months. In every class, everybody proofs their work. They take prints of their work to see what the state of their work is. Bob doesn't proof his work. He knows exactly where he's going. And he just stays with his work. over and over and over again. And there was 2 weeks ago when I was there, a couple of weeks ago, the wife had been working on something, and she printed it up, and in the next moment she sat down and started her new work. She didn't miss a beat. It's just about being in the moment and doing the work. And Kate, as the facilitator of that, she doesn't try to get them anywhere. They don't try to go anywhere. Their capacity just to be with the work that they're doing as long as it takes, uninterrupted. And when that piece is done, it's moving on to the next piece. And it's a great, I mean, for me as somebody who is so concerned about what I'm going to do and how it's going to look, you know, it's such a great model of just patience of spirit. And her ability to just rest with them in that place and honor them in that way is pretty remarkable. The last thing I wanted to say, I was teaching about patience a little bit. I have a Thursday morning group, and so I practice what I'm saying on them. And one of my women said, yeah, but what about politics? You know, what about, we spend a lot of time talking about the suffering in the world in my group. What about, you know, how do we be patient with, you know, all of the terrible, terrible things that are going on? And I think it's an important question for each of us to really, really wrestle with. And I know that, and really this is, I didn't read this part. This is, I'll say what I have to say on top of Rabbi Wein, because I think this partly answers that. Many times, doing nothing and saying nothing is the right policy at home and in the community. And the recognition that most problems in life are not subject to easy answers and quick solutions, and also contributes to wisdom and sensible behavior. Being able to wait out a child, a student, a problem, is often the only possible way to succeed in dealing with the situation. So that's one aspect. I think the other aspect is that if our hearts are not, when our hearts are in this place of patience, our capacity to respond to whatever is arising in the world is so much more profound, that the way in which we are deeply rooted in our capacity to abide, you know, if we can really rest in whatever's happening and not be reactive to it, but see it clearly, then our capacity to respond is just infinitely richer. And it doesn't mean that we have to wait until we're completely centered and completely anything. But the promise of this practice, which is true, is that as we commit ourselves, as we develop our concentration, as we hold our goals dear, as we persist, we become stronger and we become clearer and we become more able to respond for the benefit of all beings. Because that's all there really is all beings.